It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Lawmakers in Washington returned home this week to prepare for the final midterm campaign stretch. However, campaigning for re-election is not on the agenda of my first guest today. When U.S. Senator Tom Harkin retires at the end of his term in 2015, he will have served Iowa in Congress for 40 years. He's back in Iowa this week and joins us from our studio in Des Moines. Senator Tom Harkin, welcome.
Hey, Ben. Nice to be with you, at least in a distance anyway. Okay. I'm headed your way this afternoon. I'll be in Iowa City this afternoon.
Okay, yeah. For our listeners' information, I'm in Iowa City. You are in our Des Moines studio. Let's start off by inviting our listeners to ask you any questions, Senator Harkin. 1-866-780-9100 is our toll-free number. 1-866-780-9100. You can also email your questions for Senator Harkin to river2river@iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. So what are your main priorities left before you leave office, Senator Harkin?
Well, probably more than I'll ever get done, but I've always had more on my plate than I could do at one time. I'd say before I leave, I'd like to get the following done. Minimum wage. Increase the minimum wage, and we'll have that on the floor again in September. The early childhood education bill that I have, I'd like to get that acted on, along with hopefully, we've already passed it through the Senate, the child care block grant program, but it's stuck in the House. I hope the House will get that through too. The Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities, so that we begin working with other countries around the world to have them expand opportunities and accessibility for people with disabilities. The Higher Education Act, which I hope to have out of my committee. I'd like to get action on the floor, but that remains to be seen. But the Higher Education Act, so we make college more affordable and get the states incentivized to put more money back into their public higher education. Mm-hmm. So there's just a few of the things I'd like to get done before we quit in December. Assuming if we have a lame duck session or some other things on appropriations bills that I have, some increased funding for the National Institutes of Health, for example, for biomedical research is very high on my agenda on the Appropriations Committee also.
Mm-hmm. Let's delve into a couple of the topics you mentioned. Minimum wage. You've been campaigning with Congressman Bruce Braley, who is hoping to win your Senate seat in November. You've been highlighting your support for increasing the minimum wage. But some public policy experts fear a number of unintended consequences if the minimum wage is raised from its current level to the president's proposal, $10.10 per hour, namely a loss of jobs, an increase in consumer prices, possibility of a higher minimum wage attracting more experienced workers and keeping them in lower wage jobs longer. What is your answer to the criticisms of what would happen if we had this and the unintended consequences that some experts are talking about?
And my response is show me the proof.
Well, a loss of jobs predicted by the recent Congressional Budget Office report, for example.
Well, but that's, again, they did not do this study themselves. I had a hearing on this, Ben, and the CBO did not do a study. All they did is they took a compilation of old studies that were done and said sort of, well, half are here and half are there, and so we'll just sort of strike a middle ground and here's what we'll say. What they actually said was the loss of jobs could be anywhere from 0 to 1 million. And they said, okay, so we'll take the half, we'll take the middle, 500,000. What we showed in that hearing and the subsequent hearings is that that was based upon very old, now discarded studies. Newer studies that use new methodologies have basically shown just the opposite. That in fact, not only will there not be job losses, but because economists now almost all agree that one of the reasons for our sluggish economy is what they call lack of aggregate demand. Well, that means people aren't spending money. So if you can increase aggregate demand locally, that will increase the economy and that will provide for jobs. So Some of the new studies show that actually the bill would create jobs rather than lose jobs because of the increase in aggregate demand. So the CBO did not say that we were going to lose jobs, and I had them admit that. They just said they just took old studies, and they said the range is zero. It could be as little as a zero. It could be as high as a million, and therefore we'll just take the middle ground of 500,000.
Mm-hmm. What about the increase in consumer prices that would be predicted by some, driven by companies offsetting these increased labor costs?
Well, again, that assumes that there will not be any decrease in profits and shareholder earnings. Well, won't some of that also, won't they say, well, gee, there's still some good competition out there in the marketplace. If we raise our prices, maybe our competitors will be able to undersell us. So therefore, the leavening power of this is the fact that, as we know, and I think has been adequately shown, is that that profit-taking, it's too much of what we spend is going into profits, going into shareholder equity, and not enough being returned to basically job creation and basically the infrastructure of this country. So my response on that in terms of, well, they'll raise prices is no, because there'll always be other companies out there that say, well, we'll just take a little bit less in our profits and we'll keep our prices low, and that will provide the competitive edge.
Senator Harkin, you also, I understand, want indexing in a minimum wage new law there, a raising of the minimum. Why is indexing important?
Because right now, every time we raise the minimum wage, we always wait several years before we raise it again. And what happens is that people at the lowest end of the economic spectrum lose purchasing power. It's like an added tax onto them. For example, in the 5 years since we've raised the minimum wage, just the cost of mass transit has gone up 21%. Most people who make the minimum wage, a lot of them, rely upon public transportation. Well, they haven't had 1 cent of an increase in the minimum wage, yet their public transit costs have gone up 21%. Their food costs have gone up. Their heating and cooling bills have gone up. So really, they keep losing more and more purchasing power. So the minimum wage today is really, in some ways, much less than it was 5 years ago. So indexing, what we said is we'll raise it to 10-10 over 3 years and then index that in the future. And that way, we won't have this up and down all the time where you raise a minimum wage and you go several years and people make it, lose, then they come back up again. We'll keep it right above the poverty level. I just want to add, Ben, the reason people always say, well, why did you pick 10-10? Well, we picked 10-10 because that just gets you above the poverty level. If we had kept the minimum wage at the same relative rate as what we had in 1968, when it was at the highest level, the minimum wage today would be right around $10.90 an hour. So we picked 10-10 because that gets you above the poverty level and then index it for the future so that it will never again fall below the poverty level.
Let's talk quickly in the few minutes that we have remaining. Well, for instance, you received an award today, I understand, the Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Association of Community Health Centers. Congratulations on that.
Well, thank you very much. It's something I've devoted a lot of my efforts to over the years in my committee, both Health Committee and my Appropriations Committee, and that's building more community health centers. When I started in 89, we had 2 in Iowa. Now we have 14. And in fact, I'm headed to Clinton tomorrow morning to break ground on yet another new community health center. So we have 14 now. We have 85 clinics associated with the community health centers in Iowa. And they just do a wonderful job of serving people in rural areas and communities around the state of Iowa.
Mm-hmm. You played a pivotal role in the passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2010, yet the majority of Americans, some 55% according to most polls, disapprove of the Affordable Care Act. Why is the Affordable Care Act still so unpopular?
Well, I think for a couple of three reasons. Number one, we're fundamentally changing a system. We're going from a system where 37 million Americans had absolutely no health insurance whatsoever to a system where everyone will be covered with health insurance that they can afford. We're going from a system where your kids couldn't stay on your policy. They were dumped off, and that created a lot of family problems for kids going to school and just starting their lives out, to a system now where kids can stay under policy till they're age 26. We're moving from a system where if you had a pre-existing conditions, you were just out of luck. You're just out of luck, to a system now where you cannot be denied affordable health insurance even though you have a pre-existing condition. And we're moving from a system where people in the past, when they got sick, insurance companies would just drop them. People in my own family, cousins of mine who had breast cancer, insurance companies just cut them off, just dropped them. Well, they won't be able to do that in the future, you see. So we're having a fundamental shift. And whenever you have fundamental shifts like that, it causes disruptions. I understand that. But it's going to be a much better system in the future. The second reason I think that we're having problems is it's complex. We're a complex society. We've got a lot of different moving parts in America, not the least of which is city and rural, but different types of jobs. And so it's complex. There's no one little simple thing we do. I think the third reason that people are still upset about it is because it has been attacked relentlessly by members of the Republican Party and by the Tea Party and others from the very beginning without let up. And and they've sown a lot of confusion, I think, out there among people as to what's going on.
In fact, the Republican-controlled House has voted over 50 times to repeal or change the ACA. What is the future of the Affordable Care Act if the GOP takes control of the Senate?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the Republicans have said they're going to repeal it. So I assume if they did, they would try to repeal everything that we've ever done. I mean, they'll take away the protection that people have for pre-existing conditions, take away the protections for not having being dropped from your insurance and having adequate health insurance coverage that you can afford.
That's veto-proof unless they get a majority that they're not likely to get in that, aren't they?
Well, yes, but I think they'll continue to attack it and to sow the kind of confusion. Although I will say this, Ben, that people in the other party now I hear they're not saying so much repeal, except a few people, and now it's fix it, fix it, fix it. Well, I don't mind that. I'm all for fixing things. And the other thing we have confusion is because the start of it, the rollout, was really bungled. It was really very badly handled, and I understand that, and there are no excuses for that. And so it's got a lot of confusion out there among people. But I'm telling you, I was at a community health center this morning here in Des Moines, and they couldn't be more glowing in their terms of the Affordable Care Act, and the people that used to come to their clinic that never had insurance now have coverage. And what they do is they come in not when they're in extreme health problems, but they come in at the beginning where things are easier, where they can be treated less invasively than if they waited till the bitter end to come in. And I think that's another one of the benefits of the Affordable Care Act, and that is the provision of wellness and prevention that we have in the Affordable Care Act.
Senator Harkin, let's briefly talk about the immigration debate and the more recent border crisis with the children coming across the border. Last week, the GOP-led House voted to authorize millions of federal dollars to send National Guard troops to the border to stem the influx of these minors from Central America. The House also moved to overturn an anti-trafficking law meant to protect the children and voted to end an Obama administration program that has postponed the deportations of more than 500,000 young immigrants. Now, I understand you are also has shown some frustration with the White House's actions. What do you see happening from this point on that border crisis and in the larger immigration debate and comprehensive immigration reform?
Well, first of all, Ben, we several years ago, I think it was 2005, the Senate passed a very comprehensive immigration reform bill. It was a very good bill. It was supported by then President Bush. We got a strong bipartisan vote in the Senate, Republicans and Democrats. It went to the Republican House, and they killed it. And we've never been able to bring it up again until just this last year. The Senate brought up yet another immigration reform bill. We passed it with a bipartisan vote, and now it's going to be killed in the House of Representatives again. If we'd had that earlier bill, we wouldn't be in a lot of the problems we're in today.
It would have avoided this crisis with the children coming across the border?
Well, I don't know so much about the kids, but it would have avoided a lot of the crisis that we have right now in terms of undocumented people in this country and who they are and where they are, and it would have stemmed the influx of the more adult, maybe the older groups coming into America. That would have done. Kids are a different story. That's going to be solved in another way, and that is to help work with at least three countries there, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, to increase their economic standards, their standard of living, their education, their health care, their housing, and their safety and security. I met with the ambassadors from those countries just a few weeks ago, and as one of them said, you know, we have all this drug-related violence in our country, and guess what? Guess where all those drugs are going? Not to our country. They're going to you. They're going to America. So he said, we need help from America. He said, you've poured $1 trillion into the war in Iraq. I don't think that got you very much, but you could have a Marshall Plan for Central America that would raise the standard of living and provide for better housing, better security, better training for their police and others, and to cut down on the drug trade. Now, that would work. Now, these kids coming across are true. I won't say everyone, but I think the vast majority of them are refugees. They're escaping violence, drug gangs, murder, rape, and they're undergoing awful conditions to travel to the border, and they're not even sneaking across the border. They're just walking across in broad daylight because whatever they're going to confront there in the States is not as bad as what they got back home. So sending National Guard troops, that's not the answer. And I can tell you this. You asked me what I have left to do in the Senate. I'll tell you one thing I will not let happen, as I will not let the House of Representatives overturn the law that we passed in 2008 that says that a child coming across the border will be first made safe, will be fed, will be clothed, will be housed, and will be given every reasonable opportunity to apply for asylum. Now, the House wants to do away with that. Even the administration had said at some point, maybe we need to change that, and I said, no, we don't. We're not going to change it. And I have enough people with me on the Senate side that we're not going to let that happen. These kids are refugees. They need to be treated decently and humanely. Maybe some will be returned back home, but they need to be returned safely. It's not enough just to say, kick them out, arrest them at the border, send them home. What, send them back to murder and violence and drug gangs? That's not the answer. We're more humane than that. I hope we are as a people. That will treat them like refugees.
Senator Harkin, we just marked the 24th anniversary of the American Disabilities Act of 1990 being signed into law. You were the author of that bill, the chief sponsor of it in the Senate. It's had four goals: the full participation in life of disabled Americans, equal opportunities, independent living, and economic self-sufficiency. What still needs to be done on that front?
The biggest thing that needs to be done domestically is employment. It's been the most frustrating part of the last 24 years, and that is the lack of real, true employment opportunities for people with disabilities. Think about it this way. We talk about the unemployment rate in America being, 6% now? We know that the unemployment rate among African Americans is two or three times that. Same with Hispanics, and that's awful. But think about this. For every three adults in America with a disability who can work and who want to work, two of those three are unemployed. That's over 60% unemployment rate among people with disabilities. This is almost bordering on criminal in our society. So the big thing that we have left to do is to provide more job training, more of a conduit for kids with disabilities to enter competitive employment, integrated employment. I would just add, Ben, that we just passed this year, signed into law by President Obama, reauthorization of the Workforce Investment Act. It's now called the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. That came through my committee, it's my bill, and we got good bipartisan support. But one part of that is to change the way that kids with disabilities go from school, from an IEP, that's an individualized education program, into the workplace. No longer will they just go into sub-minimum wage jobs and stay there. They must first be given opportunities through vocational rehabilitation for summer jobs, for internships, job training, and then go into a real job. Not a sub-minimum wage job.
Senator Harkin, we have just over a minute left. I wanted to ask you about the race for your seat. As recently as last month, the race for your Senate seat between Bruce Braley and Joni Ernst was leaning Democratic. Now polls show the race neck and neck. Why do you believe Joni Ernst has seemed to have gained the momentum in this race?
Well, I don't know that I'm authority to comment on that. I think her ads have been great. Plus, she had a primary, and she had a very catchy ad, you know, the one with the pigs and the castration and that kind of thing. And that just got a lot of publicity. And so she got well known. And because of that primary and because of her victory in that primary, she shot way up to the top. But, you know, it doesn't surprise me that this is a neck-and-neck race. We haven't had an open seat in the Senate in Iowa in 40 years. And it's going to be a hard-fought race, and it's going to be close.
What factors do you believe will be decisive in the race between now and November? We have just a few seconds.
Well, I think, again, getting across who is for the future of Iowa. What does each of those candidates see as the future for the people of Iowa? Who is the best supporter of the middle class and the things that Iowans need to succeed and be a part of the middle class? Whoever has that best vision for the future, I believe, will win this race.
Okay, Senator Tom Harkin, thank you for stepping into our Des Moines studio and giving us some of your time back in Iowa on this beautiful day. We appreciate it, Senator Harkin.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about a decision that could drastically reshape the world of college sports. It's the so-called O'Bannon ruling. Perhaps you heard about it. Came down last Friday. It strikes down decades-old rules barring payments to college athletes. When we come back, we'll talk to two prominent college athletes who turned pro, Les Jepson and Nate Kading. Also, Bryce Miller, sports columnist with the Des Moines Register. What do you think of this latest ruling? Do you think college athletes should be paid? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Back in just a few minutes with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.